This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm just delighted to be able to host Joe Connison here at Politics and Prose. Joe is founder and editor-in-chief of the National Memo. He's the editor at the Investigative Fund, which is a very interesting entity, if you don't know about it, doing a lot of really good work. He's had a distinguished journalism career, writing for publications as varied as The Village Voice, The Nation, The New Yorker, The New York Observer, where he was editor, and others. He's written four books prior to the one he'll be talking about tonight. And each of those, if you have read them, you'll know this. If you haven't, you might want to read them. Each has added an important dimension to our understanding of the people, activities, and money behind the Republican right. Mostly, at least speaking personally, we can thank Joe for being the first, or certainly one of the first journalists to look deeply and seriously into what Hillary Clinton long ago termed the vast right-wing conspiracy. And then to go on to prove that it actually did exist. He offered the names, faces, and money trails that gave rise to intentional and orchestrated efforts to undo Bill Clinton in hopes of changing the face of American politics forever. Now Joe's written his fifth book. It's called Man of the World, The Further Endeavors of Bill Clinton, and he'll be talking about it tonight. It's a continuation of more than 20 years of reporting on Bill Clinton, this time focusing on President Clinton in his post-presidency. It covers the years 2000 to the present, looking at everything from Bill Clinton's really quite extraordinary humanitarian work in Africa to the evolution of his once somewhat prickly relationship with President Barack Obama. This and much more about the former president is offered from the vantage point of a reporter who has observed Bill Clinton from greater proximity than probably any other journalist in the past several decades. And that is something to be said, and Joe has really studied this man very, very closely for a very, very long time. Now, because I think we're all aware that transparency seems to be the operative word of the current presidential campaign, and certainly of the past few days, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I must offer the following footnote to this introduction, which is that I myself was a speechwriter for President Clinton in the White House and was for many years Hillary's chief speechwriter. So this is all just a way of saying I am extremely biased and partial when it comes to these sorts of books. Not to mention, if you can look closely, you'll see that all toes and fingers are crossed, and I may soon be in a praying position about this campaign, but I'm not supposed to really say all that because I'm supposed to be objective. But regardless of all that, I highly and as objectively as possible recommend Man of the World. It's really a refreshing book in many ways, especially in its capacity and success in drawing readers beyond really what are often superficialities, presumptions, and headlines about the politicians who lead us. To the point where we really sort of turn these people often into caricatures unfairly to us and unfairly to them. And reading Joe's book, you'll gain a deeper understanding of a very complicated, immensely brilliant and talented and occasionally flawed leader. But Bill Clinton is a true original of American politics who, even years after leaving office, I think we all can agree, continues to capture the public's imagination. So, Joe, thank you for the book. Thank you for coming back to Politics and Prose. We're always delighted to have you, and thank you for being here. Please join me in welcoming Joe Connison.
Thank you, Lissa. Can you guys hear me? Is that good? It's always a thrill to come back to this bookstore, which is a place that I love and admire. I spend a fair amount of time in Washington because my children's grandmother lives here. Grandmother and grandfather live here, so we come down a fair amount. And I come down on business, too. This bookstore means a lot to this city, as I think you know. More and more as the years go by, and there are fewer and fewer. So this is the place, and I'm very proud to be invited to come here. So thank you. I hope everything Lissa said about the book is true. You can discover for yourself. I want to say one or two things about it before I read a little bit from it. You know, I went to Africa with President Clinton for the first time in 2005 when Esquire magazine assigned a profile of him to me. And it was the year that Clinton Global Initiative was to begin. And so the summer before that, I went to six countries in Africa with him. And it was, I have to say, impressed by what they were already accomplishing there, only a few years after they had started the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which was the first big effort of the foundation, aside from the library, which by then had been built, basically. And but it still took a couple of years before I realized there was a book in this, and managed to persuade President Clinton and his staff that they should cooperate with me in producing a book about his post-presidency, which seems like it's an odd subject. I mean, you know, it's not a biography. It's a book about what he did after the biggest job in his life. And they did agree to do that, and they agreed to do it under terms that, you know, they might have considered onerous, which was that they didn't get to see any of it until it was already at the printer this summer. I mean, they got to read none of it in advance. And, of course, in August, after we had sent a copy to his office, an early sort of galley copy, President Clinton called me one day on the phone and started out with several nitpicking complaints, I will say. But in the end, he decided that the book was okay. So it's not uncritical, but I will confess, Lissa, that I would not have been interested in writing this book had I not felt that he was doing something important in the world and had done something important in the world. And so that's my confession. And now I want to read a little bit. You know, I think people will remember that his post-presidency started out on a very dark note. He went home to Chappaqua and woke up the next day after he was no longer president, went to the deli to get some coffee with his aide, Doug Band, who stayed with him, and had a nice reception at the deli from his new neighbors, but then walked out, and there were a bunch of reporters yelling at the president, who was no longer really pretty. He had the Secret Service, but other than that, almost no staff. Why did you pardon Mark Rich? And it went downhill from there for quite a long time, months. And it was an extremely dark period. His speeches were canceled all over the country. You know, it was hard for him to go anywhere without a lot of difficulty. So I'm going to read from chapter 3 when things still had not gotten better, and but he found a way out of his dilemma, or he began to. In the long aftermath of the pardon debacle, Bill Clinton was often surprised and hurt by the disdainful attitude of old friends and allies. Amplifying the negative media coverage, which he seemed unable to ignore, their withdrawal represented a judgment that sometimes seemed universal. More loyal friends worried that he was moody, sometimes angry, and worse still, distracted from thinking seriously about his own future. Visiting him in Chappaqua, former White House Chief of Staff John Podesta, a calm and trustworthy figure to whom Clinton often turned at times of difficulty, left feeling concerned. Podesta always thought of his former boss and old friend as a guy who never stays down. But that winter, Clinton struck him as downcast, stuck in a negative cycle. Nor did Clinton's mood improve when he called a meeting of longtime aides and friends to advise him on what to do next at Hillary's Washington home, situated among the Capitol's fanciest embassies and residences. Podesta, Doug Band, and his then chief of staff, Karen Tramontana, were present, as were pollster and strategist Mark Penn, former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, and Hillary, who had been enduring her own bout of bad publicity. She sat with her husband and listened as they told him bluntly, "You need to stand down for now. You are damaged goods." So much reputational damage had been sustained, they advised, that he should stay out of sight for the coming 6 months, perhaps as long as a year, focusing quietly on his library and his memoirs. This moment of unanimous, undiluted candor left their former boss very pissed off, as one observer later noted. But even as the advisors spoke, they all knew that hiding away for an extended period was not really to be expected of him. Even if he had wanted to do so, finding shelter from the deluge of public scorn during the first year of his new life would not be easy. Whatever he had lost, however, Clinton still possessed an unusual capacity to compartmentalize, as Podesta liked to put it, to turn his mind away from his own troubles and focus his attention elsewhere, at least temporarily. Soon, he and his staff came to realize that however diminished his popularity might be in his native land, much of the rest of the world was ready to welcome and even celebrate him, and he was more than ready to extend himself to an emerging global community. Actually, the first opportunity had materialized just 4 days after he arrived in Chappaqua. Late on the evening of January 25th, news outlets began to report an incredibly destructive earthquake in the province of Gujarat, India. The massive tremor measured 7.7 on the Richter scale, far stronger than the Northridge or Loma Prieta earthquakes in California, and with far greater casualties. Tens of thousands believed dead, hundreds of thousands more injured, perhaps a million or more homeless, and untold billions of dollars in property damage. As president, Clinton had been proud of improving America's relationship with India, which had declined for many years as a consequence of Cold War politics. His outreach to Delhi had been strategically valuable in South Asia and paid political dividends at home, encouraging successful members of the Indian American diaspora, many of them in the financial and technology industries, to befriend the Clintons and contribute generously to them. Over the years, Clinton had become particularly close to a few Indian American businessmen, notably Vinod Gupta, who had built Info USA, a leading information brokerage firm that was probably worth $1 billion, and Sant Singh Chhatwal, a Sikh hospitality entrepreneur whose far-flung properties included Manhattan's Bombay Palace restaurant. Both men had visited the White House. Gupta had played golf with Clinton and even slept once in the Lincoln bedroom. Occasionally, Chhatwal still sent some of Clinton's favorite menu items, butter chicken, lentil dal, kebabs, and fish curry, up to Chappaqua. During the days that followed the earthquake, Clinton began calling Chhatwal, Gupta, and other members of his Indian American circle, including Raj Gupta, no relation to Vin, a managing director at McKinsey & Company, the international management consulting firm, and Victor Menezes, a senior vice chairman at Citigroup. Now is the time for you, and I do his voice a little bit, I can't help it, but now is the time for you and everybody who has done well in your community to step up and organize aid to the flattened villages of Gujarat, he told Menezes, and I will do everything in my power to help. Clinton sent the same message to a friend in New Delhi, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, the prime minister whom he had gotten to know while touring India as president in March 2000. The first trip by an American president to the subcontinent since Jimmy Carter's visit in 1978, Clinton's warmly received visit had been widely regarded as inaugurating a new partnership between the two countries. Now, Vajpayee's staff arranged a telephone call between the Indian leader and the former president for the evening of February 1st. During that call, Vajpayee officially requested Clinton's assistance for the earthquake victims. They set a short-term fundraising goal of $1 million, but Clinton knew that his Indian-American team would be good for much more. The next day, Victor Menezes hosted a meeting in a conference room on one of the upper floors of the imposing aluminum-sheathed Citigroup Center in Manhattan, where Clinton presided over the creation of the American India Foundation. Chosen unanimously as the new group's honorary chairman, he would oversee a coast-to-coast fundraising sweep. Within 2 weeks, the AIF publicly announced its founding in a press release that led with a quote from Clinton. The Gujarat earthquake in India has brought about tremendous human suffering. It is important to harness the management skills, financial resources, and entrepreneurship that reside in the Indian community in the U.S. and use these to benefit India in its hour of need. Its board included Menezes, Chhatwal, the two Guptas, along with a score of other financial, business, and technology leaders, and, just for an extra touch of glitz, the best-selling wellness guru, Deepak Chopra. All this frenetic philanthropic activism went on well beneath the radar of the mainstream media, too preoccupied then with pardons and other embarrassments to take notice of any good works. But that scarcely deterred Clinton, who was well aware that he would accomplish nothing if he had to depend on positive press clippings. His staff regarded the Gujarat initiative as properly presidential in scope and, beyond that, highly therapeutic for him at a time of depressing daily abuse. Collaborating with the Indian American CEOs and academics, Clinton felt refreshed and energized. Every conversation and meeting about Gujarat pulled him out of his claustrophobic existence as a media target. Unlike other friends, they weren't going to dump him over the pardons or worry whether his bad press might be contagious. When he was with them, he remembered how it felt to be recognized for qualities he liked in himself: his compassion, his intelligence, his openness to the world, his concentration on problems and solutions, his capacity to bring people together for a constructive purpose. Yet wherever he went, in the United States at least, the controversies and enmities of his presidency pursued him. Not long after the debut of the American India Foundation, Clinton flew to San Jose for a major fundraising event to aid Gujarat, where he appeared on stage alongside Deepak Chopra and MC Hammer, the rap star turned preacher, at the city's biggest evangelical church. Raising more than $2 million in a single evening, that event sparked a lively controversy within the evangelical community, whose strongly conservative and Republican orientation included powerful feelings of hostility toward Clinton. During his presidency, the evangelical right's assessment of him had ranged from merely immoral to antichrist. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Dick Bernal, the founder and minister of Jubilee Christian Center, which hosted the Gujarat fundraiser, had endured a barrage of criticism from many of his own 12,000-strong flock, as well as other local pastors and congregations, since the announcement of Clinton's participation. Five families quit Bernal's church, and he received no fewer than 600 hate letters, including death threats and dark predictions that he and his family would be blown up when God passed judgment on them. They wanted to know if he was bringing Monica Lewinsky with him, the bemused pastor later recalled. They wanted to know if Clinton was going to come here and violate women in the church. Responding to the unexpectedly severe backlash, Bernal placed a large advertisement in the San Jose Mercury News a week later, apologizing for Clinton's appearance at the church. This act of contrition irritated the local Indian American businessman who had sponsored the event. "Some of the most sophisticated people in the Silicon Valley were there that night," complained Kailash Joshi, a tech entrepreneur and Clinton friend who had organized the event. "Although there was no anger here, I think the apology he put in the newspaper was an insult." Yet, while Bernal might have appeared to disavow Clinton, his own opinion of the former president was more complicated. Both the pastor and his wife had felt a surge of empathy for the former president while they watched him that evening. To her, Clinton had looked sad, while he observed that Clinton doesn't get invited to a lot of churches. Later, Bernal told the evangelical magazine Charisma that he believed Clinton had repented his sins and that God still had great plans for him. Confiding what a well-known televangelist had told him of a prophecy for Clinton, Bernal said, "The word is, God's hand is on him for a higher purpose than even being president. And God will never remove his hand from him." Within that enigmatic prediction lay the question that Clinton still had not answered. Aside from paying off his debts and building his library, exactly what was he supposed to do with his energy and talent? I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. In Gujarat, he had found a compelling cause, with donors so enthusiastic and generous that the American India Foundation increased its fundraising goal to $50 million and scheduled a week-long visit to the subcontinent led by Clinton, primarily to assess the conditions in the desolated western region. His experience as governor and president had afforded him considerable expertise in dealing with disasters, both natural and man-made. Returning to India a little more than a year after his historic March 2000 state visit, Clinton's itinerary included a couple of days touring the damage in Gujarat state, a morning at the late Mother Teresa's orphanage in Calcutta, and a banquet hosted by the Prime Minister in New Delhi. No paid speeches were on the schedule, with a far smaller entourage, including a dozen AIF leaders and a humanitarian rather than geopolitical agenda, the trip established a post-presidential style that would serve as the template for many of his foreign tours. Usually, he would enjoy all the perquisites and comforts due a visiting head of state, traveling via sleek private aircraft, staying in the very finest hotel suites, eating at the best tables in the best restaurants, riding in black Chevy Suburban SUVs with his Secret Service detail, flanked by local police vehicles and motorcycles. His staff made a valiant effort to uphold that standard, as did his hosts. It wasn't always possible. When Clinton stepped off the Indian Airlines plane that had taken him from New Delhi to Bhuj, one of the largest and most heavily damaged cities in the state of Gujarat, the temperature under the glaring sun was 41 degrees Celsius, or just under 106 Fahrenheit. Wearing only a dark green t-shirt and khaki slacks, he jumped into a blue Jeep with Doug Band, joining a slow crawl of 24 vehicles, somehow without air conditioning or bottled water, that were packed with members of the AIF contingent and local dignitaries. The perspiring convoy headed out from Bhuj's airport for the towns of Ratnal and Anjar, a trip of less than 30 miles that would take nearly 2 hours to complete. Along the roads, thousands of men, women, and children had lined up to greet the motorcade, applauding loudly and crying, "Clinton, Clinton," as it arrived an hour late. What they found in the flattened villages left Clinton and his companions stunned, stricken, overwhelmed. There simply wasn't much left of those places. Their small stone houses and concrete storefronts all tumbled into a jagged rubble of rocks, broken red roof tiles, and smashed wood beams, all strewn amid streets that nobody had cleared 2 months after the quake. Yet the people of the towns, furious that the government had so far failed to restore their villages or homes, were nevertheless thrilled to see the tall, white-haired man from America, an important man whose presence would, they hoped, draw fresh attention to their dismal living conditions. Dozens of young women and children greeted him with tossed rice and flower petals as an elderly woman anointed his forehead with a reddish dot of blessing. Their energy lifted Clinton as he spoke. "Today, I have come to look, listen, learn, ask questions, see what we can do to help," he said. "The people of this place have lived through an unimaginable tragedy. The most important thing is to see whether this can be rebuilt." He said the world had not forgotten them and promised that soon much more help would be forthcoming, a message he repeated at every stop. "He's a big personality in the world," a dazzled truck driver told the New York Times. "Something good will come of his visit, though we don't know what it will be." The Times headline on the trip, featured on page one, treated him like a downmarket showbiz personality. "Whatever happened to Bill Clinton? He's playing India." Gujarat state officials handed out a glossy brochure in every town Clinton visited, which claimed that following the earthquake, the state government immediately swung into action and mobilized all available resources. The entire machinery of the state responded to the calamity with fortitude and determination. That blatantly aggrandizing message contrasted distinctly with what the survivors told Clinton and his friends. Government at all levels had failed them so far, providing little more than a $40 stipend along with some sheet metal shelters and plastic tents. After 2 months, many thousands remained destitute and homeless. "Nothing has been done and nothing is going to be done. This is all for show," complained a teacher as he waited to see the former president. "If Clinton stayed here a month, maybe then we would get some proper help." Reaching Anjar, their main destination, the visitors from America went straight to a street where one of the most horrific incidents had occurred. More than 200 elementary school students were parading on the morning of January 26th to celebrate Republic Day, a national holiday, when the Tumbler suddenly toppled buildings from both sides of the narrow lane and killed all of them. He was supposed to unveil a memorial plaque there, but that plan, like the relief efforts in general, had gone wrong. The memorial assemblage had been placed mistakenly on private property whose owner, irritated because the authorities had not first asked whether his land could be used, had removed the plaque, leaving only the modest stone pedestal. Rotting garbage and ponds of sewage surrounded the area, a situation that local workers had tried to remedy by hastily covering the ponds with dirt and broken stones. The smell, combined with the heat, was almost overpowering. In remembrance of the dead children, Clinton set a bouquet of roses down on the stone pedestal and bowed his head for a moment of silence. There were no words adequate to this tragedy, but he had to try. "We will raise funds to help the people of Anjar to confront their loss," he promised. "We have a plan to see if money can be given to people to rebuild their lives. We are interested in seeing results." Sweat running down their faces and soaking their clothes, Clinton and his companions piled into their cars for the long, hot drive back to Bouj, where the International Red Cross was operating a makeshift medical clinic to replace the city's badly damaged Jubilee Hospital. A CNN reporter at the clinic described Clinton as visibly shaken by what he had seen already. At the Red Cross site, located on the ruined hospital premises, he held a news conference with a crowd of mostly Indian reporters. Saying that much of the money raised for disaster relief had not been deployed very well in years past, Clinton explained that the AIF planned to collaborate with other non-governmental organizations and the Indian government on focused action to restore jobs, education, and housing to Gujarat. They would develop a program based largely on what he and his colleagues had witnessed. In the years ahead, Clinton would try repeatedly to improve the world's response to the desolation and trauma of such vast disasters. Now, his voice quavering slightly with emotion, he mentioned the March 2000 state visit. "I will never forget it. I have always wanted to come back, but this sad event has brought me back earlier than expected." Before climbing into his Jeep, Clinton made another vow that he repeated at every stop. "I intend to come back to India for the rest of my life." He met with relief officials from the Red Cross and other agencies the next morning in Ahmedabad to discuss what they needed in Gujarat and how the AIF could be most helpful. By then, the scale of the destruction and suffering that they had witnessed was spurring him and his AIF companions toward more and more ambitious plans. Later that day, they announced that AIF had raised its fundraising goal for Gujarat to $100 million, with tentative plans to adopt 100 villages for reconstruction. In his meeting with the relief agencies, Clinton seemed to be grasping at larger aspirations for himself as well. According to Vimala Ramalingam, the Secretary General of the Indian Red Cross, he expressed a desire in that meeting to support other humanitarian work across India, particularly to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS. He also talked about discovering new ways to solve problems in Gujarat that could improve the lives of poor people in villages around the world. "One of the things I'm interested in," he later told reporters, "is coming up with a model which will be helpful in developing other villages in India or Africa or Latin America that may not have had natural disasters but would like to build a different future." During the afternoon, he toured Akshardham, a 10-story, hand-built, pink sandstone edifice in Gandhinagar that is one of Gujarat's largest Hindu temples. He was received with a big garland of crimson and white flowers hung around his neck as women devotees chanted a peace prayer. Standing before the great temple, he looked up, marveling that such an enormous building still stood perfectly intact, without any support from steel or concrete. "The earthquake has not damaged Akshardham?" he asked Pramukh Swami Maharaj, the guru of the modern Swaminarayan sect, which emphasizes service and tolerance. It had not. The Swami walked him through the complex, trailed by monks swathed in orange robes and Secret Service agents perspiring heavily in polo shirts. Despite the torrid air, again over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, Clinton noticed that he felt surprisingly calm and comfortable. Scheduled for 15 minutes, the tour stretched into an hour as the Swami and the former president ventured beyond the temple into a garden filled with statues and carved stones, including a life-size likeness of Gandhi. Then Clinton's glance fell upon an extraordinary artwork, the figure of a man sculpting himself with a hammer and chisel from a giant block of yellow stone. "What an amazing, incredible idea," he blurted. "So powerful." The Swami smiled. The sculptor's metaphor of self-realization intrigued Clinton, who stood and gazed at it for minutes. At last, someone reminded him that they had fallen behind schedule, and that some of his companions were almost fainting in the heat. Before he left, Pramukh Swami introduced him to temple volunteers working in the earthquake relief effort, and to a Muslim man who told Clinton that although there was not a single Hindu family in his village, Akshardham had sent workers, construction materials, and food to aid the people there every day since the quake. In the visitor's book, he wrote, April 5th, 2001, thank you for welcoming me, for making me feel at home, for reaching out to all God's children, for helping the people hurt by the earthquake, for working for peace and reconciliation. Bill Clinton. So now, if you have questions, I'd be delighted to take them. Yes.
I should say, I went to law school with the Clintons, and my late husband was part of the administration.
Everybody's going to do full disclosure this evening, so we could get very interesting. Yeah.
In his post-presidency, did he also give speeches like Hillary did for money?
Oh, yes, many. He made much more money than she did giving speeches. At the beginning, a lot of the speeches were canceled in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But overseas and in Canada and lots of other places, there was still a huge demand. He was the most popular and well-compensated speaker, I think, ever in history. I don't think he was ashamed of that. He once said to me how great it was to be rich, having been, poor or, struggling financially for most of his life. He enjoyed making money. He didn't go on corporate boards or do some of the things that other guys had done in their post-presidency. Didn't want to do that. And he thought speeches was a good way to do it because he was paid a lot. And by the way, this had nothing to do with her or the Secretary of State or any of that stuff. It started long before anybody thought she would be Secretary of State or imagined that she would ever be president someday. So I don't think it was pay for play as the
right.
He was genuinely popular. And in fact, the tickets for his speeches would go for, big prices. Any organization that hired him to give a speech could count on making back the money that they were paying him and more if they sold the tickets. There was one organization in Canada that sold out, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of tickets in a day, and they wanted to move the event to a stadium with 3,500 seats so they can make more money, but it was too late to do that. So yes, the answer is he made a lot of money and gave a lot of money to the foundation, by the way, I should say, and paid his taxes and disclosed his taxes every year. In fact, the Clintons have disclosed. The reason people know how many speeches he gave and how many she gave and for how much money is that they disclosed all this information on their taxes, and they've done so every year for almost 40 years. So they're... When they're accused of not being transparent, there's another side to that. So,
thank you.
Sure. Yes.
For me, one of the most meaningful aspects of President Clinton's post-presidency is his collaboration with former President George H.W. Bush on relief work for, if I'm remembering correctly, the victims of the tsunami.
That's correct.
And Hurricane Katrina.
Both right.
Thank you. And my question is, what do you find particularly meaningful about President Clinton's work with former President Bush, and what do you think are some of the most important things that one can learn from the collaboration between those two former presidents?
Well, I think what President Clinton would say is that it showed our common humanity. And that's more important than partisan differences. it's actually one of my favorite parts of the book is describing how they became friends, very close friends. And I will tell you that in reading what President Bush wrote to his friends about President Clinton, he changed my opinion of him. I didn't have a great opinion of him after his presidency, and I still quarrel with many things he did that I think were terrible. But as a person, he turned out to be, in my view, a very sensitive and an interesting man, and became very close to Clinton. I mean, their relationship has been described as like father and son. President Bush has said that himself. He became very fond of Bill Clinton, and Clinton declared that he loved President Bush. They were very successful together, I think, because of that decision to collaborate, that bipartisan, the aura of compassion, nonpartisan compassion that surrounded what they tried to do was very effective, and they raised more money, I'm not going to remember the exact amount right now, but it's in the book, than anybody had raised in that kind of a fundraising drive in history up to that point for the tsunami victims. It was enormously helpful. Now, the other interesting thing about that was, of course, that after the tsunami, the then President Bush, President George W. Bush, had kind of flubbed it. I mean, it was kind of a preview of what was going to happen with Hurricane Katrina. He stayed at his ranch for his Christmas vacation after the tsunami occurred. They announced that they were going to provide $15 million in relief to, one of the most devastating incidents that in human history. And he was not visible. I mean, he didn't come out and talk about it. And Clinton came out and spoke about it a couple of times. People, you know, reporters came to him and looked for his opinion about what the U.S. should do to help the victims of the tsunami, which was just unbelievably devastating. And at first, the Republicans criticized Bush for Clinton for talking out of turn. You know, why is he talking? And the answer was because Bush wasn't saying anything. Then they turned around and and they got a call from the White House to Clinton's office saying, would you be interested in helping former President Bush raise money and for relief? And Clinton immediately said yes. And then they went on the trip together, and that's when they became friends. So, yes.
Thank you. During the Bill Clinton administration, I was working on the World Bank's Africa program. And one of my frustrations in that work was the general reluctance of the U.S. administration, particularly AID and the State Department, to truly partner with other development assistance providers. The U.S. always wanted to put its own brand on what it was doing in
right.
And was always more conscious about the political benefits to the U.S. of its aid program than most other donors. I wonder if the Clinton Foundation has been more willing, more successful in partnering with other development financing and implementation institutions than state and AID was during the Clinton administration.
Well, I would say yes. And the reason is that from the beginning, you know, President Clinton was, he once said the era of big government is over. I'm sure you all remember that. Which I came to believe was a meaningless phrase that escaped his lips. But because when he was running the foundation, the attitude of the foundation was that they were going to work with government everywhere and that they were not going to take much credit. I mean, now people know very little about what they've done. And one of the reasons is that people don't go around in any of those countries wearing Clinton Foundation T-shirts and putting up big signs about Clinton or any of that stuff. They put the government in the forefront in every one of those countries, the local government. They work very closely with the aid agencies of other countries. In fact, when you read about foreign donations to the Clinton Foundation, what they're mostly talking about, and they always compress the timeline a lot, so it looks like, well, they gave that money because of Hillary. And in fact, the money for the AIDS relief and other medical projects began to flow long before she was Secretary of State. And it came from places like, you know, the Canadian Aid Development Agency, mm-hmm. and the UK, DFID, and Norway, and Sweden, and all these places where Clinton still had friends in high places and called them up and said, I'm going to start providing AIDS treatment in the developing world, even though you know, the global health authorities have decided we're not going to do that. It's too expensive. We're going to do that. And I need money from you. How much? What are you in for? Mm-hmm. And Jean Chrétien would say, well, I'm good for $30 million. And, you know, eventually Tony Blair kicked in some. And the Scandinavians, of course, were wonderful. And but he wasn't trying to take credit for that. I mean, they didn't go around. He would go, you know, once a year, he'd go through Africa and visit some of the sites in various countries. And that would draw attention of the local media and boost the morale of the people who were doing the work, the volunteers who were actually on the ground all year in very hard places, and some paid. And but I think they were successful in the way that you describe. I think that was the philosophy of it from the beginning.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was on the National Finance Committee for Clinton, and then wound up working for Vice President Gore. And
I'm glad you confessed all of
that. Well, you'll see why when I ask the question. And I'm an admirer of the Clintons. But I was wondering what you thought of the criticism that the Clinton Foundation has accepted foreign government donations while the secretary was, Clinton was the secretary, and also what you think if we hope Hillary is elected president, what you think the role of the foundation and Bill would be with the foundation, which a lot of kids
will. Well, so to answer the second part first, today the Boston Globe had an article about the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which is the biggest part of the foundation by far still. And it said basically that it will be spun off. And I predict that in the end of the book, because they've been talking about it for months. But there was a news story about it today, that it will be spun off and that the Clintons' family members will step down from the board of that organization. And Ira Magaziner, who created it, will also step down from the board, although I think he'll probably end up still running it, at least for a while. But some other entity will take it over. As far as the foreign donations are concerned, what I think about them coming when she was Secretary of State, you know, if anybody is upset about that, they should ask President Obama. Because when Hillary Clinton was asked to become Secretary of State by then-President-elect Obama in 2008, he spent about a week or two persuading her to do it. Her first answer was no. She wanted to stay in the Senate. He eventually persuaded her, and she ended up feeling like when the president asks you to do something, you say yes. So, but there was a but, which was, what do I do about my husband's foundation? Because there is clearly, he is involved in many foreign countries, not just taking money from foreign countries, but working in foreign countries, you know, dozens of them. So how do we handle that? And Obama had his transition team negotiate an agreement called a Memorandum of Understanding with the Clinton Foundation that would govern the relationship between her husband, his foundation, and the State Department if she was confirmed as Secretary of State. And, you know, I mean, I've read that document, and I know what happened in the negotiations over it. And basically, they did everything Obama asked them to do. They argued about some of it for a while. For instance, President Obama, and I think rightly so, but they didn't like this for their own reasons, and there was an argument on their side, too, demanded that they disclose every donor. Now, keep in mind, other presidential foundations have never disclosed all their donors, not a single one, including, you know, the Bush family's foundation, which was building a library for the first President Bush while the second President Bush was president in the year when he was running, taking donations from foreign governments as well for that purpose. And that's fine. But President Obama asked the Clinton Foundation to disclose every donor that it had ever had before she became Secretary of State. Those donors had given their money under the understanding that their names would not be disclosed, you know, just like any other foundation. Foundations do not have to disclose their donors in this country. And the Clinton Foundation agreed to do that so that she could work for the president, join the cabinet. They told all the donors, we're going to disclose your names, and you don't have a choice about it. Not one of them protested. They were all fine with it. And all those names were disclosed. Not only that, but the foundation continued to disclose every name of every donor after she stepped down as Secretary of State. To this day, they still disclose all the names, and now they're doing it more frequently than they were before. So, you know, to be honest, I think a lot of my colleagues are obsessed with sort of phantom conflicts of interest, with the appearance of conflicts of interest, which is sort of like the appearance of a ghost in the house. I mean, it could turn into something real, perhaps, but you have to weigh that against what the foundation accomplished with all that foreign money, which was, at last count, had saved 11.5 million people with AIDS treatment, which isn't just giving them drugs. It means providing testing and counseling and all kinds of other things. In all these countries, they'd rebuilt the health system in Rwanda, which now has the best health care in Africa. They had saved many, many thousands of people from malaria in Tanzania and other countries. I mean, there's a long, long list of accomplishments that impacted real people's lives. So when I weigh that, which my colleagues seem actually very deeply uninterested in, against the thing they're so interested in, which is whether Hillary took a phone call from somebody that she's known for 30 years, you know, I have some difficulty with that. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Thank you. I hope you go on national TV.
Well, I've been a little on this week. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My only disclosure is that Bill Clinton was the first campaign I volunteered for and the first person I voted for president. So I don't know how, that's it.
I don't know how you could admit that.
My question is with respect to his relationship with Vice President Gore. You know, famously in 2000, Gore made the strategic, I think, miscalculation of keeping a distance from Bill Clinton as when he ran for president, and we all know how that turned out. You don't really hear much about a Clinton-Gore sort of subsequently over the last 16 years. Is that out of personal hurt? Is that just the two don't just pursue different agendas? What's your perspective on Clinton-Gore post-presidency? Thanks.
Well, for a while, they didn't talk much. I mean, I don't think that's a secret. And certainly during the first most of the first year that Clinton, after Clinton left the White House, they did not speak. And there was definitely some hurt and anger over the way the 2000 election had turned out and Gore's attitude towards Clinton and so on. But he always respected Gore a lot. I think there was always mutual respect. And then there's a story in the book about how on 9/11, or the days after 9/11, Clinton was in Australia on 9/11. And Condoleezza Rice, after some persuading by Clinton's staff, sent a plane to Australia to pick him up. Because you remember the airspace here was closed. So it was very hard for anybody to get home who was abroad in those following days. Poor Al Gore was in Austria and couldn't, and they didn't send a plane for him, okay? So he had to, he flew to Canada, a place called Gander Airport, which is in Newfoundland, and it's kind of the nearest airport to the East Coast up there, and drove down in a car. And Clinton had, and Clinton's staff and Gore's staff were friends. They didn't fight the way the principals did. So they knew each other, and they were talking, and Clinton and Gore spoke, I think, briefly. And then they arranged for Gore to stay at Clinton's house in Chappaqua on his way down to Washington on that long drive, because he was driving himself down from Canada. You know, once you're out of office, you don't have, like, the things you used to have, especially if you were vice president. So they drove down. He came to the house in Chappaqua, and he came up, and it was 4 a.m. by the time he got there, and Clinton had waited up for him. And Gore walked up the steps, and they were doing something to the kitchen and moved the refrigerator out onto the porch, which if you've been to the South, you know that that's like something that happens, you know, it's but not in Chappaqua. And Gore looks at the refrigerator on the porch and he says, "You've come a long way, haven't you?" And then and Clinton cracked up. And then they stayed up all night talking about, you know, the terrorist attacks. And they went to the National Cathedral together over here. And the next day, where President Bush spoke, And then Gore had the Clintons to his house in Virginia for lunch, and things were better after that. And I'll tell you, Clinton, you know, their interests actually coincide a lot. Clinton is obsessed with climate change and has been ever since Gore sort of schooled him on the subject. And he's obsessed with the clean energy transition, and we'll talk about that later when we talk about what he might do when, if and when Hillary becomes president. But and Gore has appeared several times at Clinton Global Initiative as a keynote speaker. I mean, they give him a lot they feature him there. I mean, he's highly respected there. So I think the relationship is better. It's not like they're best buddies, but they do have a good relationship. Yes.
I was watching when Hillary was negotiating the platform with Bernie Sanders, how meticulous she was at keeping her word, you know, point by point with Sanders. And I'm writing a book on Adlai Stevenson, on the effort to draft him in 1960. Mm. And Stevenson also was meticulous about keeping his word. He kept saying that he was not a candidate, but he would accept the draft if the convention deadlocked. But he was meticulous on his word. One of the people I interviewed was D.B. Hardiman, who was chief of staff to Sam Rayburn. And he reminded me that the currency of politics is your word. And take a look at Donald Trump. I mean, here's a guy who can't keep his word for more than a few minutes. And he shows no interest in government. My question is, as a seasoned observer of politics, how is he going to deal with Congress?
Who, Donald Trump?
Yes. I mean, how could he possibly deal
with... Well, that's not something we want to find out, is it?
No. But, I mean, it seems to me that no one seems to be raising this among the media.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think Paul Ryan really wants to find out, to tell you the truth. I mean, I would suspect, or Mitch McConnell. But listen, there is a value to experience. It's not just your word. It's whether you have any idea what you're doing. And there's a value to experience. The fact that Hillary Clinton served in the Senate and served well in the Senate and was thought of well by her colleagues on both sides is a recommendation to her ascension to higher office that is, in my view, underemphasized. But that's my view. Yes, sir.
Yes, your earlier comments about Bill Clinton complaining that he was quote-unquote poor. That seems pretty disingenuous to me, given that, you know, he lived in the White House for 8 years, which is a considerable house. He had servants protected by Secret Service.
Well, I said it, not him. I said he had been certainly poor growing up. I should clarify that. So he was poor, certainly compared to everybody in this room, when he was growing up in Arkansas. He was not wealthy at any point in his career until after he left the White House. And in fact, as everybody knows, he left the White House deeply in debt. But when he was, the fact is, in a place like Arkansas, public servants are not too well compensated. And,
Well, he did all of that out of a personal choice.
He
wasn't like somebody, you know, forced him at gunpoint to
You're absolutely right. He would agree with you.
You know, and the low compensation jobs, etc.
Absolutely right.
So,
that it? I agree with you. He certainly did it by choice, and I think he would say it was the right choice.
And you could also argue, you know, one of the reasons why he was broke when he left was, you know, the seven-figure legal bills that he and Hillary had accumulated.
Yeah, I wrote another book about that. You should read it.
Under various circumstances.
Yeah, you should.
Which I'm sure they had at least something to do with.
Well, I would say they had very little to do with those circumstances. In fact, you know, about Somewhere between $50 and $70 million was spent investigating Whitewater, which you might know is a land deal where they lost money that had occurred before, long before he became president. Now, why the Congress would decide, and in its wisdom, that we should spend that much money investigating a defunct land deal, I don't know. But it ended up costing the Clintons a huge amount of money to defend that for no reason whatsoever. So I wouldn't blame them. I'd be, you know, as I said, I wrote another book about that. I commend it to you. Any other questions?
Okay, last question. And can I just say before, sir, you ask it, just a reminder that we have plenty of copies of the book up front. Joe is happy to sign. And when we're done, if you could move your chairs to the side, and you've got the floor.
Okay, well, your last comment makes me want to bring up a second question. So I'll do that one first. I agree there was nothing to Whitewater. But it seems to me that the real problem, as I remember watching the thing unfold, was the Clintons spent their time acting like they were guilty of something, and that's what really fed the thing.
Well, I don't agree with that. But, I mean, the press treated them as if they were guilty of something, but that doesn't mean they acted as if they were guilty of something. They acted on advice of their counsel, which I think was all that they could really do. You know, the press... with the help of various Republicans, as I outline in The Hunting of the President, you should clearly read it as well.
I've read it.
Okay, so, but you don't seem to remember it that well. But
it's 10-15 years later.
You could always, well, I'll tell you, so we did something this year. Gene Lyons and I created a an abridged version of the book that we give away free online to anybody who subscribes to the National Memo, which I edit and Gene sometimes writes for, called The Hunting of Hillary. So you could look at that, and you'd have it would tell you as much as you need to. You don't have to read the whole book over again, although it isn't a bad book. But but I don't think they acted guilty. I think they acted to protect themselves against people who were out to destroy them, you know, unequivocally. I mean, with every tool at their disposal, which at that time included some very powerful tools in something called the Independent Counsel Act, with Independent Counsel being a prosecutor who could not be controlled by any part of the government. I mean, there's a reason why they let that act expire when it was done, because they didn't want it to be used against any Republicans, because it was an unbelievable piece of legislation. And Kenneth Starr, who you may have noticed was recently kicked out of Baylor University and got what was coming to him, had used it to, you know, the fullest extent possible to try to, I discussed some of that in this book, too, because while after Clinton left the White House, the final report of the Independent Counsel came out, and it was a very interesting document. So there's a good part of a chapter in this book about all of that still and how it concluded. But the short of it is they really abused their office to try to destroy them, and I think it's the idea, which is still obsessed on by some people in the press. Karen Tumulty was talking about this in the Washington Post the other day, that somehow this was the Clintons' fault is just, I mean, it's shocking that any journalist could say something like that, because it shows how little, after all these years, she knows about the subjects that she supposedly is covering. Okay? So that's, and I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joe.
I never got my question.
Copies of the book are up front.
I never got to ask my question.
I'd be happy to sign.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.